This is The Light Inside. I'm Jeffrey Biesecker. Living in Istanbul for 10 years, inspirational speaker and author Sean B.W. Parker gained note as a successful lecturer through his work at Istanbul University. As a published author, he's given TED Talks and communicated on the world stage. Although navigating life and its emotional swings both up and down has not always been easy for Sean, nor has speaking itself come free of complications. In fact, as a child growing up in the rough and tumble environments of South Wales, Sean struggled to speak at all, having experienced language development challenges as a result of stuttering. And to make matters even more difficult as a child, he grew up in the shadows of three older brothers. Despite these challenges, Sean learned to leverage his speech much to his advantage. Yet our story today doesn't end just here. Find out how this journey to international recognition took a sudden, drastic, life-altering turn, landing him in one of the UK's most famous and notorious prisons, and the lessons we can learn from Sean about naming our emotions when we return to The Light Inside.
When it comes to mobile service providers, with their high rate plans, extra fees, and hidden costs or expenses, many of the big name networks leave a bad taste in your mouth. Mint Mobile is a new flavor of mobile network service, sharing all the same reliable features of the big name brands, yet at a fraction of the cost. I recently made the change to Mint Mobile, and I can't believe the monthly savings, allowing me to put more money in my pocket for the things which truly light me up inside. Making the switch to Mint Mobile is easy. Hosted on the T-Mobile 5G network, Mint gives you premium wireless service on the nation's largest 5G network. With bulk savings on flexible plan options, Mint offers 3, 6, and 12-month plans, and the more months you buy, the more you save. Plus, you can also keep your current phone or upgrade to a new one, keep your current number or change to a new one as well, and all of your contacts, apps, and photos will seamlessly and effortlessly follow you to your new low-cost Mint provider. Did I mention the best part? You keep more money in your pocket. And with Mint's referral plan, you can rescue more friends from big wireless bills while earning up to $90 for each referral. Visit our Mint Mobile affiliate link at thelightinside.us/sponsors for additional mobile savings, or activate your plan in minutes with the Mint Mobile app. For most of us, it's almost unfathomable to imagine what it's like to live life behind prison walls. Our guest, Sean B.W. Parker, has experienced this firsthand. Having been wrongfully convicted of sexual assault, he spent 6 years battling the English legal system and then incarcerated at Dartmoor, one of England's most storied prisons. The facility has gained such a reputation that it even has its own museum. I cannot begin to imagine the emotions and potential trauma Sean has experienced in regard to his journey, and I'm sure you can relate as well. I can almost feel a tightness in my own chest as I imagine the closeness and isolation of those four corners, the tightness and anxiety rising as I do so. Sean, for many of us, putting our thoughts and feelings into words can be particularly difficult. This kind of sets the stage for our show today. This ability to express ourselves is especially apparent when it comes to voicing our emotions. For some of us, it becomes increasingly difficult when we have a particular challenge with simply voicing and expressing ourselves. Sean, you know trauma firsthand, having experienced some difficulty and challenges as a result of your conflicts within the criminal justice system in the UK for the past 6 years. You also personally have a large battle going on within your patterns of speech, having experienced stammering or vocal stuttering from an early age. First and foremost, I want to thank you for joining us today. This is quite a deep, introspective story to look at. It must have presented so many challenges in both circumstances. So thank you for being open and vulnerable with us today to share those experiences.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Jeffrey.
I'm excited to dive into this story because it is such a juicy, broad-looking perspective of so many different angles to look at and how we approach our emotional interactions. So from that perspective, Sean, could you share a little bit about your experience with that particular battle and struggle, first and foremost, within the criminal justice system?
Sure thing. In kind of about 2016, 6 years ago now, 7 years ago, I was running an arts and music venue here in Britain on the South Coast, where I live. And over that year, we became very popular, but very unpopular with the local council. So we had all those tensions within licensing and things like that. At the Christmas of that year, we lost our license because of my co-director was selling alcohol without food, which is a thing that's quite controversial here. And the week after that, I was at the height of the Me Too movement. I personally received some allegations myself on those lines. 14 months later, I was in the Crown Court here in England and going on trial. And I was advised by my barrister to not speak because your stammer could be seen as a sign of guilt. So I didn't actually speak for myself in court then, and my stammer was much more intense than it is now. It's gone through all this in life, as I'm sure get into. And then I was found guilty, and I'm still maintaining innocence and all sorts, appealing. That's a whole other story. And I went to prison for 4.5 years. And in the first 6 months of that, I could barely speak in prison. I couldn't get a word out because of the bizarreness of the situation there. That's the nugget. That's the essence of what happened with me in the criminal justice system then. But now I'm the editor of False Allegations Watch. I'm out and I'm working on trying to help people to be more sort of transparent and to in stammering and in the criminal justice as well.
It's such a challenging position to find yourself in, because here in one light, you're trying to present your best foot forward, trying to assert your innocence and your stance on things, yet you're automatically being stigmatized and judged based on something that's inherently not directly involved.
That's exactly right. And the term you use there, stigma, is a thing that we've been looking at with the Empowering the Innocent Project, which I work with in Bristol. We did a documentary called The Bonfire of Agreed Terms with the South African director, Odette van Rensburg, who has a focus on stigma, and she's worked on suicide, and now she's working on false allegations because her son went through the same thing. So lots of people tend to connect when they've gone through this bizarre fire. Yeah, so that's also what we're working on, stigma in general.
So from that experience, let's back up a little bit to the very situation, to stammering and stuttering. As a child, you started to develop this pattern and this routine habit of stammering and stuttering. It's a lifelong journey you've traveled. Let's reel that back in your personal experience. Where did you start to form this pattern, and when did you first start to experience the stammering and stuttering?
I think I usually trace it back to the age of 5, which is actually 1980. So give your viewers an idea of my age. So around then, my parents were very talkative. There wasn't much love in the house. It wasn't a hateful house, but it was mismatched, is how I put it. He was a drama lecturer at university, and she was a speech therapist. And so there's a lot of words going on everywhere. And I had a very talkative older brother who resented my presence. So basically, I was sidelined. Which has happened with lots of families, of course, so we don't blame everything on that. But I was the baby, and I just became an observer, and I would watch and observe how they were and look forward to getting out of that, to being my own self in the future. And when all the conversations were going on, I only interrupted a few times before I decided there's no point in doing that. And then the block starts to come even when you're not being interrupted. And it's like, ah, what's happening here? But you're not aware of it until you're about 12. You know, that's when you start to become adolescent and aware.
During this family experience, Shirley felt a great sense of disconnectedness in a place where you struggled to feel both heard and seen. Is there anything you remember from your experience, Sean, about the feelings that might have been arising for you?
It's a really interesting question because I suppose I did feel left out, but because it's a very natural thing, I've gotten, you know, I talk to myself to get my best information. One of those persons, I don't really have to go out to get assurance, you know? So, and I was the same back then. So I just go out to, we had a big garden and fields and things like that. We lived in the country. Yeah. So I would go out to the country and just be with nature. And that was my nurture, I think. So I kind of considered them to be rather unusual, but I love them. But I'm just like, well, I can't speak on the same level as these people. Yeah. And the family, your family, you don't always really get on, do you? You love them, but you don't always get on. And so I kind of knew that at sort of 4, 5, or 6, really, I think.
So considering that, did you start to find yourself maybe searching for that sense of connection and belonging?
I think I must have, yes. And I didn't really probably get it until we went to high school here in sort of South Wales, because our dad, after they divorced at the age of 9, my age of 9, we went to South Wales, which is away from where my mum was, which is a terrible schism in the family. And we were in a different part of the country, Wales, which, to be honest, is quite hostile to England. And I'm an Englishman going into Wales.
Yeah.
So you're receiving a lot of racism in a way. I don't know what the terminology for it, but kind of othering. So there's some more othering going on. There's a stammering and then there's being English in Wales. But then I got into music and sort of Nirvana, Guns N' Roses, that era. And I started to play guitar and to sing, and things got better in the sense of inclusion, I suppose.
So here you are, you're thrusting yourself into another, or you're being thrust, I should say, into another situation where you're looking for that sense of connection, that sense of acceptance. At this point, share with us a little bit about how that perception of you being a foreigner coming into this new environment, a young person at that, and then someone who's also being experienced for the first time with this condition of seeing and stuttering. Share with us a little bit about how that experience played out for you.
That's a good summary. I was aware that this was not the ideal situation, being there in kind of Carmarthenshire with my dysfunctional family, with my dad and my brother now, so just the three males at home. And what's the way out of this? But whilst you're doing that, you're not really living in the moment. So I would go into a creative world, and very happily, and I still do that, I'm an artist, you know. So it's what I tend to focus on is what to produce. So the production becomes the nurture, I suppose. I would start to write poems, still do that. And then in time, basically the process of creating is a joy. And I hope it would be the same if I hadn't gone through some degree of environmental sort of trauma, as we put it. I don't particularly like to traumatize myself, but the nature of what we're talking about here does bring out the fact that even the most innocent sort of seeming stuff can have its odd effects.
When the stammering condition surfaced and some of those signs first start to present themselves, how was that perceived or managed from your parents' point of view?
Yeah, of course, absolutely much more difficult for them than it is for me at that point in the late 70s, you know, as between 75 and 80, let's say. You're very ambitious parents who just want to do better with their lives and but are pulling apart, are watching their boy, who they have brought into the world and are trying to instill principles of the English language. That's been our family's, you know, it still is. You know, I love English so much. Many stammerers do, stutterers do. So they're watching this unfold in their son, and they're kind of powerless as to what to do about it. And between sort of 5 and 12, as I've mentioned, you're unaware that you're doing it. That you don't know, and you're not stressed. You're just making a different kind of sound. possibly aware that you're not sounding like anyone around you, but you don't care. You don't care until you're older. You go to secondary school and you start to develop hair under armpits, and the whole of the context sort of changes. And added to the factor in Wales, it's like, wow, so you can't speak at home, can't give a good presentation, can't start to read in class. When you, and that's the point where you start to feel the shame, as mm-hmm. as you've mentioned, is when you're having to read in class there. Here comes Sean. I was called Ben at that point, because I've added Sean to my name at the age of 20 because it was easier to say, but now I can say Ben easier. So, but here I come, and I couldn't get the words out. And it was a shame, because I'm doing what I can do, which is to read, but I wasn't able to actually produce it. So that gives itself its own kind of shame, for sure, age of 12, 13.
So give us a little point of reference here, if you will. How many brothers do you have, Sean?
I've got the one full brother, who's he here in Britain. He's 3 years older than me. And then I've got another two much older brothers in their 60s now. There's the one that lives here, who's the oldest at 67, and another one who lives in Louisiana, Baton Rouge. He's the head of graphic design at Louisiana State University. So for a bit of reference over there. Yeah. So it's an odd family, but my dad had two sort of sets of boys from two different wives.
Brotherhood can be a very challenging, unusual dynamic in and of itself from my own experience. I struggled sometimes with my own relationship with my own brother. Do you feel, or how do you feel, that interaction might have played out with your brothers? Was there some backlash with experiencing some of your conditions around your stuttering and your stammering?
It's a wonderful question that's never been asked before to me at home or outside. Great. The older brothers that I mentioned, always subconsciously, very quietly, the family doesn't talk about it, always considered, you know, sort of me and James, the younger ones, to be of a lesser caste, because we were after their mother, which is in my dad's early life. So after my dad went on to his next life, we were considered this other lot who weren't of any, you know, just lesser basically. So, and we hardly saw them because they were getting on with their own lives elsewhere. Though we kind of loved them and it was cool. It's just families, you know. But with my direct older brother, James, who obviously I'm very genetically close to, and we look very similar, etc., have the same English love and of music. Apparently, he did say he remembers being 3 years old and kind of looking around the bedroom door at mum, looking after me when I've been born, and basically wanting to kill me because that's what children do about the new younger brother. And that competition, subconscious competition for the mother's love, I think is powerful. It's the Oedipus complex, isn't it?
I have to kind of dissect that relationship with my own brother, but knowing that our core dynamic was one of that kind of conflicted struggle, we're trying to constantly one-up each other, can be such a challenge. Do mm-hmm. you feel that might have been leveraged against you, or how did you experience that then in regards to the stammering? Did they see that maybe in a different light, or use that in some way to leverage against you?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. That as a young boy, he was the one that was going to, because he's the firstborn of that set of the family, he's the one where the pressure is on to be the one to go and do things and be of the world, you know. And he did that, has done that reasonably successfully, whatever, you know, we both have. But it's like he has a natural role to do that. And the younger one, the golden child or whatever we are, has another responsibility inside the family to almost be an entertainer. So I'm not an entertaining kind of bloke, but I also take on that kind of position. It's much more light, basically. The responsibility doesn't feel there, though in reality it is. There's loads of responsibility, but you kind of you're not really expected to do it somehow or other. It's the family dynamics, isn't it?
Yes, quite. I think that surfaces for each of us in a unique experience. I think from my own, I struggled with a lot of kind of bullying, harassing behaviors between the two of us. I was equally as guilty. I have to kind of own my own responsibility and kind of leveraging some of that back at times.
Well, you've got a right to defend yourself, haven't you? Surely.
is such an interesting dynamic to study within our male societies, our male community interactions, in air quotes. It was a topic I just shared at a family gathering with both my father-in-law and a cousin. So, you know, it was interesting to see that kind of comforting aspect first and foremost, that we often go through a lot of those same relatable experiences, very unique to us, but there's kind of a core fiber in those communities and those social confines of conception. Within that criminal justice system, let's zero back to that a little bit. Do you feel some of those same kind of patterns of judgment and expectation had to have start surfacing in regards to how you're presenting yourself, how you're showing up for court cases, how the lawyer obviously is guiding you through that circumstance?
Absolutely. Being that entertainer character we were just talking about, or I don't know, person who does colorful things, suddenly, because of this venue I was running, which is a responsible job, but also verging into entertainer job. So, but that responsibility suddenly became of interest to the authorities. So it's like, it's not a joke anymore. So there you are in the courtroom, having loads of stuff said about you, which you don't recognize, because that's the nature of justice trials. I'm sure it's the same in the US. You know, it's like, who are they talking about? And there you sit quietly. And whilst it's all being done over you, over your head, and you're basically an object. It's not even personal. It's kind of personalized to your visage, but it's not actually personal. And the thing is that even if I could speak fluently back then, 2018, you don't actually get a chance to in court. You don't get a chance to stand up and say, this is nonsense, none of this happened. You're at the behest of the barrister who's trying to get certain answers out of you. And then if I had stammered back at him, he would take that response as a sign of guilt or dishonesty, neither of which is the case. So it's maddening, basically, that situation then. And I think it's given me a lot of impetus to get this book out, to be honest. So I don't talk much about criminal justice in compelling speech, but it's definitely a subtext of the whole thing.
That's an interesting study for me to look at. I worked in the music promotion business for about 10 years.
So
I know firsthand that career realm can come with a lot of preloaded stigmatization from culture in general. You know, that view of a musician, you know, they're kind of lack responsibility, they're kind of more lazy outliners. You know, some of the things that I've typically observed and witnessed where you kind of automatically are seen as that rebellious other in a lot of regards, automatically to me sets some of that stage of challenge. You're automatically set into that light where the biases are there already to begin judging.
Absolutely. And the biases wouldn't be particularly inappropriate when it came to me. I used to drink too much. And I was quite, I don't have a high kind of moral, sometimes I can't say the word, so I spell it, moral, sort of stance of myself, because there's too much of that out there in culture at the moment. I'm the best, I'm the right one. No, I used to drink too much and I was quite promiscuous. I don't deny it. And because I don't deny it, the solicitor's saying, you've got to deny it, you've got to deny it. I'm like, no, I'm not going to deny what I am and what I used to be, rather, because I haven't had a drink for sort of 5 years. I haven't had a drink. I'm not abstinent, but I haven't been drinking like I used to at all. So those kind of cliches that they apply to promotion do apply, but I was always a gentleman. And that's what's so, you know, did I used to abuse that? I wouldn't say I abused it. I was just living in an approved culture, which is... But that's the Me Too situation, which we got just as bad as happened out there to you guys.
We just came off an interesting episode yesterday that focused on that cycle of blame, how we often look to find that fault in things and where to place that responsibility. Coming out of that conversation gave me a new perspective on how that kind of transparent ownership of our responsibility ultimately kind of shifts us out of some of that guilt and blame when we truly empower it.
Yeah. When it comes to getting involved in stimulants, because a part of what we're talking about is that,
yeah,
is that those stimulants were, I think I got into drinking too much after my dad died in 97, that I was talking about, yeah. Dad. So after he went, I split up with my young wife, you know, we were young brides, and we split up then, and I started to drink, basically, his inheritance. So and then I had a nervous breakdown off the back of that, from panic attacks, from over drinking, that kind of thing that happens with basically alcoholism, but I didn't call myself that, but the too much drinking led to this. And then because I was trying to make up for lost time, and the alcohol would help me speak to women, so you would start to relax. I would still be stammering, but the alcohol would be a tool to be able to speak better and to relax about the whole interaction. Because Britain's a terribly tense country, especially when you're middle class and things. So it's just like, you know, that. But the booze tends to get rid of that, and that's why it's so cultural here. So definitely the conviction, the job of being in music promotion, and the alcohol are all somewhat hand in hand, though it was never what I was put away for.
So in that regard, with your stammering and your stuttering condition, you had to create such great internal anxiety in a lot of circumstances for you. Is that something you commonly experience, that anxiety as a result of it?
Absolutely. This idea of anticipatory anxiety is very, 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 very good, very, very sharp, accurate. Because when you're a self-aware person, as you probably are and I am, you know, you're just aware of your place in the world, it makes the response of the other just as important as your own. And that will create its own anticipatory anxiety where you kind of consciously you want to please, you want things to be okay, you want things to be relaxed. And subconsciously, speech kind of pathology is doing its own version of that, which is I'm going to block without Ben Shaw knowing it. So it worked as a saboteur, actually. And that's what I talk about in compelling speech quite a lot. Your speech patterns are a sort of silent bandit, but underneath your speech. And there's a proper example of what I used to be like.
I want to share a little secret with you today about a podcast booking and matching platform I truly love. As a podcast host and guest, my go-to podcast booking app is podmatch.com. If you currently have a podcast, regularly guest on podcast, or if you are new to the podcasting game looking to start your show, podmatch.com is an industry leader. They quickly and effortlessly connect ideal podcast guests and hosts. Their process is super easy and highly effective. Create your free guest or host account and set up your profile. It's really that easy. And the Podmatch AI will work its magic in the background, delivering your ideal interview matches within minutes, tailored uniquely for you. As a host and executive producer of the top 100 self-improvement podcast, The Light Inside, I found more high-quality guests on Podmatch than anywhere else and in a fraction of the time. So if you're looking to expedite your podcast booking experience, fill in your calendar with high-engagement content, creating value and meaning for your listening community. Check out podmatch.com, that's podmatch.com today, and discover your ideal match magic. We've all been in situations where we felt mixed emotions. During a major life decision, such as buying a house or accepting a job offer, you might feel both joy and sadness. Or maybe you feel mixed about how COVID-19 has shaped your life. According to psychologist Naomi Rothman, mixed emotions can help us make better decisions, such as considering the risks associated with a decision or thinking through potential outcomes. However, under stressful circumstances, we often struggle to identify our emotions. This is because the part of the brain that processes emotions is not as well developed as the part of the brain that processes logic and reasoning. And is it any wonder, with over 27 categories of emotions and with 87 or more sub-emotions being identified by noted authorities, one in four adults struggle to accurately assess, identify, and express their present emotional status. Considering such daunting data, this task is bound to prove challenging at times. Therefore, it can be even harder to recognize and understand our emotions when we're under stress. Recognizing and labeling emotions enhances our awareness of our natural emotional cycles and patterns, allowing us to better understand and navigate our emotional experiences. This practice activates the process of neuroception, which is our subconscious detection of safety or threat cues within our environment. By naming emotions, we bring them into conscious awareness, reducing the likelihood of automatic and uncontrolled reactions triggered by the autonomic nervous system's flight or flight response. Instead, we gain the opportunity to regulate our emotions consciously, allowing us to choose more adaptive responses in engaging the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system for relaxation and emotional regulation. For those who experience certain speech challenges, issues that often result from emotional trauma itself, this task becomes especially difficult. Speech challenges can often cause a lack of self-confidence, which can be made worse by the fear of being judged or even the fear of failure. This fear can make it difficult to find the words or the courage to simply speak up. Emotional trauma can trigger physiological and psychological responses in the brain, including the release of stress hormones, which can affect various areas involved in speech production. This can lead to heightened self-awareness and anxiety about speaking, further aggravating the stammering patterns. Sean, let's reel back toward the book a little bit. Give us a little background of where that turning point kind of came for you, where you were inspired first to write that book.
Right, good. In the Dartmoor Prison, which is the oldest prison in the UK. It's like our San Quentin or whatever. It's a 200-year-old kind of prison in the middle of the Devonshire countryside on Dartmoor. I spent 2.5 years there after the issues with the Crown Court there. So, and you can say, apart sort of from the breakdown I talked about earlier after the drinking, this was obviously a societally imposed dark point. You're on your own. You've been sent to prison under the worst, you know, the state can't do anything more to you. So you become rather, you're down there and you're coming out.
Rock bottom moment we often reference.
Rock bottom moment. I've had a couple, you know, and that was the other one. And the difference is that I don't think I'd done anything to actually deserve that degree of treatment. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't giving myself the hard time that I was in the late 90s because I got myself into that position by drinking. And then what am I doing? I'm losing my mind. But this one, I wasn't losing my mind. I was just purely determined to get out of this as best I could. And that has ended up in this kind of chat we're having now, which is a sort of transparent, rock bottom, coming up, redemption, sure thing. But don't forget that don't consider myself guilty of this, which can put me in a different position than lots of other criminal justice experienced people. But we don't go on about it because I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable. You know, it's just what I'm dealing with in the back. But this book, Compelling Speech, I would grab it. I don't know. Hang on. Sorry, Jeff.
No problem. We'll pause a moment.
I hope your viewers forgive me. There it is. Just to let them know it actually exists. Compelling. I started to write it in Dartmoor because you're in a cell and of the evenings, you don't want to watch the TV all the time because it's a brain killer. So you have your dinner and turn off the TV. I do. Mm. But I got very creative, a poem a night and a letter to somebody, to a justice reform organization or a journalist. And I thought, right, well, let's talk about compelling speech then. And I also wanted to put a TED talk that I gave in 2013 in Istanbul, stammering and creativity. It was the biggest thing on stammering for quite a few years until TED took it down because of the conviction. So it got like 40,000 views on there.
Yeah.
And it was a really helpful tool to lots of people who stammer. So I thought I would try to capture all that in a book, in a slimline book, and then after I come out to have it as a part of my post-release back to creativity push.
That's another interesting little twist here, how we've got a platform like TED that's designed to kind of guide us through some of those more challenging instances in life, yet we're being stigmatized again. We're being withdrawn from that, even though that material is still inherently beneficial, even though there's a value in that. Even more so for me, I'm kind of zeroing ahead. It's kind of mind-blowing to me, because what often will happen then is we'll go back to that TED Talk. Okay, now this individual's kind of run their course with that incarceration experience and now come back with another insight from that. And we're eager to consume it again. We're eager again now to kind of capitalize and materialize this very unfortunate incident. It's kind of an interesting conundrum to look at without trying to be judgmental and stigmatizing myself. To simply say, it's very interesting how we can kind of fluidly shift that perspective to kind of suit our own biases.
Absolutely. The rehabilitation process on both sides of the Atlantic is bizarre, to say the least. I'm actually the European correspondent for NARSOL, which is the National Association of Registry of Sex Offence Laws, Rational Sex Offence Laws, which is a brilliant American kind of resource on such things, where basically these tech companies, as useful as they are, don't care and don't respond. And basically they've got a line, which is if you've been convicted of, like, I can't come to America except to, like, possibly give a lecture or two if I have a special invite because of a conviction. And all kinds of other countries too. I mean, they can't stop us doing what we're doing, you know, which is great. But they have all these absolute laws, which are ridiculous, including Facebook. But they don't care about the maintaining innocence. They don't care about the nature of the conviction, about the police corruption, all these other elements that go on behind a trial, you know. It's quite maddening, but I'm not the guy to get maddened. I'm just the guy to carry on and try to find intelligent ways forward, you know.
I commend you for finding that positive path forward, my friend. We've spoken with a number of people who have dealt with that past incarceration. I'll frame it that way. Conviction in and of itself automatically is insinuating the perpetuation of a supposed guilt. I'll frame it that way to try to be as objective as we can. It's interesting to see how we, throughout our global law enforcement, our global societal systems, will then impose that kind of continued perpetuation of double jeopardy. You are now stigmatized. You are now the pariah. You now are carrying that forth. How do we responsibly weld that as a society becomes a much big, broader picture than what we can probably unpack in a single show.
And it's become industrialized sort of since, without getting too political about it, and to talk about the politics of another country is always problematic, but yeah, between us, is that kind of after the Title IX thing, you know, coming out of America in 2011, Joe Biden signs it off, and basically the campus college rape situation has been, you know, there are companies which will basically harass the colleges to sue their own students and to end the rest of their lives. Mr. Owen, sort of L-A-B-R-I-E, Owen Labrie, and all these, I know, very controversial young people in your country, but over here they're just sort of discovering them, because then we just took all that and turned it into Me Too, and then they're piling it all at our justice system at the moment. And I'm just trying, with Empowering the Innocent, to educate people into what's going on, which is basically the criminalization of young men, without wanting to put too fine a point on it.
We're kind of jumping around a bit today. I hope you are graceful in that. I'm going to stop a moment here and kind of reel back between you and I. Going back again to the time frame of your incarceration, considering your stammering issues when you were entering Dartmoor Prison, were there any resources available to assist you?
I had done a lot of good work in stammering because I used to be an English teacher in Istanbul. For sort of 10 years, stammering wasn't perfect, but by the end of that, I was able to do this TED talk. So I'd got to a position of more comfortable speech, at least. And that was going on until trial, basically, you know, getting better and better. And then, zoom, like the conviction itself, the criminal justice system itself, I just pulled the rug out from underneath me. And what compounded that inside was the fact that basically the way other prisoners speak is it's not how I speak, because you're not allowed to have this kind of conversation we're having now inside, very rarely anyway. Yeah. We're talking in a rational way, and loads of other prisoners were just not rational. They were just paranoid and concerned about things that I wasn't, and about the prison regime and things like this. So it was a completely different area of, I don't have comorbid kind of criminal behaviors. So there's not much to talk about. And I had a couple of pals, but so when that's the situation, and there's not much to say, you don't say much.
Yeah.
So the stammer doesn't get any better, you just keep internalizing things.
I'm sure with that sense of isolation returning again, you know, that I would imagine you feeling that also exasperates the condition itself with that anxiety.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You're closed in and you don't have the internet. You don't have any of the things that they don't have yet anyway, not the proper internet, you know, access to computers eventually to do some educational work. But it's basically, you know, the prisoner state here, as I understand in US 2, is basically offline because they are paranoid about transparency. And though there's a phrase, you get sort of sent to prison for punishment, as punishment, not for punishment. Mm. So, you know, actually going there is the punishment itself. You don't expect it to be worse when you get there.
Yeah.
And it's not so much it's worse, it's just completely, it's a purgatory. It's a parallel purgatory to society. So it's dead. It's very boring. That's the main, it's not violent.
Incarceration, we don't call it prison reform until somebody comes back and looks at the prison system and now let's reform the system. From my perspective, would you somewhat agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is incorrectly done. And we are attempting to copy the incarceration business model of America more than we've been doing because it's a massive business and we haven't been exploiting that enough, apparently. So I think we're trying to copy certain things. I just hope they copy the right things, which I've been kind of over in Norway. They're doing it right, and with a bit of luck, we'll do that in Britain. I don't know.
Without straying too far down that political trail, I hope some frame of reference. Looking into that situation again in Dartmoor, was there a perception with the guards in your interactions when they would encounter your stuttering? Did they see that as a way to kind of judge you and maybe treat you differently in some regards?
You quickly start to recognize the ones who are nice and good to talk to and the ones that you aren't going to bother with. And so the ones that are nice, the handful of them, everything becomes quite quickly on the basis of a chit-chat level. So you probably don't really have to do anything to the actual kind of the guards doing the lockup and things like that. When you have to go to certain parts of the prison to do work and to request things on the telephone, so it's not even in prison, it's just being on the phone, that's when things become very difficult because my stammer comes out when required information has to be heard, when it's essential that they get that part of information. I live at blah, 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 blah. That can be a real challenge, like your own name. And so that's the point where things become worse because that's all prison cares about is what's your prison number, what's your name, and what do you want? So if any of those have a difficult kind of pronunciation thing, like at the moment I have a difficult time with L's. So I don't know why. Nobody really knows why that's going on right now, and it'll change next year. And if I have a thing that has a bunch of L's in it, I'm not going to be able to say it on the phone, and I'll get more stressed not doing that. And the guy behind me will be possibly stressed, though. Yeah. It's a chain reaction of trauma, basically.
That's interesting then to see how that inability to express the emotion, this case very realistically guided by your physical interaction with it, your condition that's guiding it, making it difficult to express just yourself and then not alone any emotions behind it, exasperating that very condition.
Absolutely. the only place inside where people were allowed to be their full self, which I think is what you're trying to get towards, your full self. Yeah. If I'm on stage, I'm being that full self and possibly in a classroom. But other guys would go to the gym and they would be their full selves in there. And I wouldn't, because it's not my thing, but they would come out of there so themselves. And all the criminal past and all the rest of it evaporates away because they're coming out sweaty, happy, testosterone has been expelled, you know, used. And you watch that and you go, well, that's a really interesting lesson into not being snobby and not being odd about prisons, because that's what he needed to do and it's good for him, you know. And they'd often try to encourage me into it. I'm like, I'm completely fine with that, don't worry, but thank you very much, you know, because I get my my satisfaction in different ways, you know, with the creativity.
Let's look at that role that creativity plays throughout your life and being able to connect with those emotions. Maybe projecting on that a little bit, or probably a lot, but share that experience for you back to an early age. Where did you first find that connection with creativity as a source of expression for yourself?
I first understood that I loved fantasy worlds of like creating fantasy and living in fantasy in those fields I was talking about in the back gardens and of our farm. And I would actually kind of imagine stories around the clumps of grass and the molehills and things like that. And I would create a child's fantasy around that and think it was the most important thing in the world, and basically obsess on that thing until it goes away. But I'd just be completely happy in that place I've from time to time thought almost autistic degree, but I've not had the diagnosis or anything, because I don't see it as a block in my life. I don't want to know, but I do creativity in a very focused way, and it started then with those stories. And then up into school, up into Wales, I'd start to write lyrics for these bands that we were in, grunge bands, and normal adolescent stories and a bit gothic, you know, all those things we were doing in the late 80s and 90s, and were expressed in the lyrics I was writing for them, until I got my first poem published in the local paper, 1995, age of 20. And I'm like, oh, I'm in the paper with my poetry. Isn't that nice? And everything after that has been everything after that.
So with that relationship, do you ever go back and kind of explore that and say, you know, I've seen something new in that, or something different in how I relate to that creativity?
It's a place that's very, very pure, and it doesn't lie. Mm. And kind of however much you want to have it look good, it's going to be itself. So you stop attempting to make it look good. You just present it and go, I've done this. Do you like it? You know? And I think it's an interesting thing I hadn't thought before, but we were talking about the gym just now.
Yes.
It's the version of that, because sport and the gym are, it's a real place with no lies and no politics, you know? And it's just that person being happy and being expressing themselves. And the creativity, I think, is very much kind of connected to that in its own more head kind of way. For sure.
It's such a great way to view it for me. You know, it puts a lot of perspective there for myself to see how that act of kind of free expression, free liberation, is just when we get out of the way of it, simply connecting with our core self.
Totally, totally. Couldn't agree more.
That's such an awesome revelation to share. I'm glad you brought that to light today, because I think that's so essential in how we look at things. Yeah. You know, going back to the theme of the show, not to beat our drum, maybe to beat our drum a little bit, I'll go ahead and say that. Finding that inner light, you know, just allowing that light to freely shine and express itself.
Well, completely. You're obviously kind of making the connections here. And as I was inside it and feeling partly resentful and kind of angry about what had gone on, so there'd be poems about that and essays and that kind of thing, you know, my practical objective part. But a much bigger part was much more about, once all this is done and gone, I'm going to want to go out there and communicate with people like you about what it's really all about. And unfortunately, it does involve a little bit of politics, only to the extent that in the media, there's a lot of lies. And the good thing about the podcast culture is that we do get around the lies by having an honest conversation, you know, and it's so valuable and people are loving it, aren't they? Joe Rogan, you know, he's the man and you're doing your own version of that, you know, if you know what I mean. And it's brilliant because you actually get a discourse of honesty.
You know, that's the beauty inherent in all of it to me is we're finding these connections to simply just meet each other and sit literally eye to eye. Mm-hmm. And say, I'm here, I'm open, I'm vulnerable to communicate with you. As you moved back into that music community, what do you feel like that time frame of acceptance was? Do you feel like you were openly accepted as a musician, maybe even with some of that knowledge of your past history? Or was that something that also created another challenge?
Well, you're talking about kind of in school there.
As you're coming out of Dartmoor and you're now starting to put yourself back into that entertainment community, you're actually starting to perform again. Was there a healthy transition for you with that where you felt more accepted, perhaps maybe a little quicker? Or was there also a struggle for you in any of that?
I've put the performing life behind me somewhat because I've got completely into writing and sort of back into painting as well. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of that inside of it, and I love it. So there's a lot of painting and writing going on now.
Yeah.
However, at Open Prison, which happened after Dartmoor, we went for 18 months then to finish off the sentence in Open Prison, which we do here. It's not completely open as you walk around the village, but it's not completely restricted.
Yeah.
I got into the prison band and I started to play drums as I first started back in South Wales, sort of playing the drums. And it was really formative. So it was a bunch of old hits, which I enjoyed doing, Dire Straits and The Cure and all these kind of things, and Beatles. But apart from that, I was able to be the drummer between two guitarists who were basically, if they're watching, hi guys, but they had incredible mental health problems and there were real behavioral shit going on. So the only way I was able to deal with it was by being the calm, cool water between them. And that, I think, might be the one experience of my entire life that's been the most useful, is in taking myself, my ego, out of any space and just allowing them to be crazy until it goes away and then be good when they come back. So you're almost being a parent to these two guys who are sort of 10 years older than me. Do you know what I mean? It's a very unusual relationship, especially for the baby of the family. But I'm just trying to help them because I'm in their band, you know. But you just do it by calmness and by being rational, because there's not much rationality inside.
That whole relationship of ego for each of us, first and foremost, you know, we're not informed, again, very much like with our emotions, with a lot of those core underpinnings of ego development. You know, we experience a lot of very stigmatizing awarenesses that guide what we believe is ego development or even ego experience. So that's an area of current fascination for me. We're doing a lot of research into how we develop and evolve through ego. I'm starting to tie into concepts from Jan Levinger and Susan Cook Gutner that look at that more evolved sense of ego, how we utilize it more as a perceptive filter, just like our emotions. You know, I think a lot of us are coming in from that core aspect of a monistic, very one-dimensional, if you will, aspect of ego as something either you have or you don't have. He has an inflated sense of ego, which moves us through some of those phases of development. I love that reference you used of taking the I out of ego. I wish they would have spelled ego with an I in the word and changed the words. We actually can literally do that. Maybe help us out in seeing that perspective of taking that self perspective out sometimes is where that kind of monistic view does come in.
Mm-hmm. Well, couldn't agree more. So,
that was my podium moment. I'm too gracefully bow to that today, I'll say, because that was, I tend to have those podium moments sometimes. And sometimes that ego does then even unconsciously adversely step in where we start to share that limelight or sometimes overstep that limelight.
Yeah, I hear you. But the ego itself isn't a bad thing. It's kind of amoral and it exists. And I'm if anything, I'm an individualist, right? And which is has its own controversies, but I believe in the individual. And then, but the bad part of the ego is the id, isn't it? Mm. So then that id is the thing that I had to get rid of, that kind of practice room, because then the id is just me getting in the scrap and with these other two fearsome prisoners. You know, what's the point in that? You get rid of that guy, but you just leave the thing there which helps, which I think is the amoral positive part of the ego.
I want to thank you for so brilliantly bringing back where that I steps in. Thanks for that reminder today that it is there, that we kind of do have that framework and construct baked into it. I want to sit with that a moment. That's such a great point to make, that, you know, that's how we can illustrate and see that from your perspective, Sean, where that sense of I can step in and just finding that point without blame and judgment.
Absolutely. That's the one thing I've always, my entire life, been, and I'm still very much continuing to be, is no blame and judgment or stigma, because I don't like it when it's done to me. I don't like it when it's done to other people, and I don't bully or gang up or tell lies, you know. And if you have those principles, it should be okay. But you do have to get rid of the drinking as well and other things, apparently.
I want to thank you. I feel like this kind of makes a nice summation, exclamation point in our conversation that expresses things quite well. So thank you for sharing this conversation today, Sean.
I feel like I've had the best counseling sort of session that I've ever not had. So it's been brilliant. Cheers,
Jeffrey. The greatest therapy comes from our human connection, when we simply see and recognize each other.
Yeah.
Plain and simple from my perspective. I want to offer you an opportunity today. Where can our listeners reach out to you and connect with your book?
Thank you. Yes, they go to, I'm not going to pick it up again. If they go to Amazon, Sean B.W. Parker, that's my pen name, S-E-A-N-B-W Parker, Benjamin William. That's my given name, if you remember. They can see my 8 books on there, and this one here has got 4 5-star reviews. So I'm very proud of it. And it's very real, very honest. And it's the summation of what we've been talking about for an hour here, basically. So it's if they fancy my stuff, it's a good place to go.
Fantastic. I know we didn't spend a significant amount of time really looking at some of those patterns of stammering. So reach out to that book. I feel that's such an interesting perspective to look and learn so much about what we can glean from your experience, Sean. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
You're so welcome. And just to put a little end point on what you just said there, that thing with anticipatory anxiety is a word I hadn't thought about until today. And you have nailed what's going on with the stammerer in reference to nervousness about the pre-thought, which is there in all of us. So I think you've just given a contribution to that book and the whole of speech therapy debate. Anticipate your anxiety.
That was a connection that would probably not have come to light had it not been for you presenting the opportunity to explore your circumstances and your experience. So thank you, my friend, for bringing that awareness.
Marvelous. Welcome.
Namaste. The light in me acknowledges the light in you. I'd love to have another conversation soon.
Absolutely. We'd love to do that.
Thank you, my friend. Our emotions play an integral role in shaping our perspective. They also contribute significant data assuring our overall health and well-being, a fact that we often underutilize when assessing our core personal development. Decoding our emotions and the many feelings that result can at times be a difficult and frustrating task. The next time you find your emotions getting the best of you, consider this experiment from the University of California in Los Angeles. Dr. Michelle Krask tested out her hypotheses about labeling emotions. This action can help people with the fear of spiders by having them approach a large live tarantula in an open container outdoors, then bringing them inside, going on to put them in front of another live tarantula and dividing them into 4 groups. Dr. Krask and her colleagues measured how close participants got to a live tarantula, how distressed they were, and how much their hands sweated. The group that labeled their fear of the spider performing far better than the other groups. As discovered in the study, recognizing and naming of emotions seems to bridge the gap between thoughts and feelings and reminds us that the emotion is temporary.
This allows us to be at peace with our feelings and simply listen to its message. And as a result, we are able to see our emotions and the interactions that result in a new, more empowering light. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone you love. And as always, we're grateful for you, our valued listening community. This has been The Light Inside. I'm Jeffrey Biesecker.